Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Scoop on July 28th, Monday, July 28th. We're at the final Monday in July, believe it or not, cruising right into August and right into a congressional recess period, which is not as much fun as elementary school recess was. As I said it out loud, I thought recess period sounds like great. Didn't you look forward to that when recess was? We should have recess. Why did we do away with recess? Everyone needs a little recess in the middle of the day where all of us get to go outside and play. Am I onto something? I just stumbled upon this just right now. I feel like you go outside, you take a couple swings on a swing set, you might jump around, play a little four square, just move your body, and then come back and do a little work before lunch. Listen, recess. Let's bring it back. The congressional recess looks a little different than that, but I'm into it. I feel like, you know, some things just, as soon as you say them out loud, they suddenly sound like a good idea. That sounds like a great idea. I loved Foursquare. Is anyone else into Foursquare? The bouncy rubber ball and, like, you know, I remember that the dodgeball, war ball sort of scene was a little violent periodically, but the four square, two square sort of action I was into the bars. I was into that sort of stuff. Where did that time go? You know, you're on something really good as a kid, and then suddenly you grow up and you suddenly don't do those things. But I feel like should be brought back. And I see those on the live chat agreeing. Amy loves Foursquare too. Amy, we could have played together. What was the game too, where the ball, now it's escaping me. The ball is on a string and there's the pole. Is anyone with me? Do you know what I'm talking about? And you hit it and you try to get it wrapped around the pole. Someone tell me what that is. Tetherball? What is it? Thank you, Natalia. Tetherball. These are good games. Why? Here, all of us are counting our steps, doing the weighted vests, doing all the things. We just need recess. 10, 20 minutes of recess? I feel like it's in. Robin and Amy are in tetherball. Okay. Listen, you heard it here first. I think we start a little viral trend. It starts catching on. It's sort of like the four-day work week. We can just keep going. Well, it's great to see all of you today as we move into August. The August schedule might look a little funky. I'm actually traveling next week, so we're not going to have a live Scoop broadcast as we normally do. I hate doing that. If I'm available, I'm doing Scoop, but I'm going to be mid-travel. I don't know what the Wi-Fi situation is going to look like, so we will still have a special report delivered to your inbox for Scoop Insiders, but our broadcast schedule could look a little funky next week, so just a heads up on that. I'll be paying attention to the news. So will the rest of the team. Absolutely. And we'll continue to have information for you, but just wanted to give you a little heads up on that. Second thing I want to give you a heads up on is a follow-up to a story that we did last week that caught on in the middle of the week. But again, you heard it first here on Smarter News when I said, this is a story we really have to watch. And that was about beef prices. Suddenly by midweek, you had the Today Show and everybody else talking about beef prices. Thankfully, CNN, we'll give them a shout out, wrote an article early last week, which we quoted, but seeing that article right away, I thought, man, this is really important because if we're talking about any sort of prices that affect food in a significant way, we want to watch it because of all these bigger issues about questions about inflation and how much your dollar is buying you and what does the economy really look like. And I want to show you this story, thankful to Stephanie for flagging this for us as she was looking at news this morning. I hadn't seen it, but this is something to watch, and it is, I'm going to bring it up for you that are watching live. This will be in your show notes as well. This is unfortunately, hold on. Let's see if I can pull it up. Okay. So this is an article that is detailing what is a parasitic fly. And it's called the screwworm. But in Latin, this translates to man eater. So we're going to, I was like, whoa, well, how are we going to start off this Monday broadcast? Let's talk about man eaters. Okay, let's do it. But this is something that you may hear about. The title of the New York Times is Avian Flu Wiped Out Poultry. Now the screwworm is coming for beef. The parasitic fly that attacks warm-blooded animals was eliminated by the United States in the 1960s, but it's creeping towards the Texas-Mexico border. And so again, a parasitic worm It's a threat to cows. It also can be a threat to humans. I'm going to read this line. Livestock, wildlife, pets, and in rare cases, humans can be affected. But it's something that farmers are paying attention to because of concern about what this can mean for herds. And one of the reasons why we're seeing beef prices up so high is that we've seen herds of cattle being affected. You know, one of the ways they've been affected is through the bird flu as well. Although unlike culling entire groups of poultry like we did, we're not doing that for cattle, but we have seen sick cows because of bird flu, and you have all other sorts of dynamics as well. But this is something to keep an eye on. As soon as I saw the comparison to bird flu, I thought, wait a minute, we got to watch this, especially because we're seeing higher prices. So that'll be in your show notes, but just want to kind of put that little something on your radar. I've never heard of a screw worm. The minute I saw a man eater, I thought, okay, now that's going to stick in my mind. And something to watch as we move forward into the back half of this year. The president has been traveling overseas, and I just want to give you kind of a quick lay of the land when it comes to politics. We don't know what we don't know, so the unexpected could definitely arise. But we do have something on the calendar for both the House of Representatives and the Senate, and that is the break. So the House of Representatives is already back in their home districts. That doesn't mean they're not working. It just means that they could be taking some time off with their families, but it means that they're doing local meetings. They're not in Washington, D.C. You're not seeing the hearings or the votes that you typically do. August is scheduled off, so we don't expect them back in Washington, D.C. The Senate is finishing up a few tasks, but they also are going to be off for August. And so they are also not going to be in Washington, D.C. unless they choose to be so. And so you have lawmakers for Congress that are basically back home, and we have a more of a quiet period in Washington. This will give the president, if he chooses, really the full microphone, because you're not going to have Democrats, Republicans, and interpersonal issues suddenly being on the big screen. It doesn't mean we won't see interviews. It's just a different pace of business. The president is traveling overseas right now in Scotland. We expect him back into Washington, D.C. shortly. Part of his time overseas has been because of these trade deals that he's trying to negotiate with the EU and also with the UK. And as of this moment, there are deals with both. The reason why this is important is August 1st. Let me go ahead and pull up the calendar. So August 1st is this Friday. So we do have a couple of days. That is the deadline for tariffs to come into effect. And so, for example, with the European Union, the president had talked about 30% tariffs. The EU had talked about 10% tariffs. They settled on 15% tariffs, and there is a deal in place with the EU. By the way, I didn't know this. In the way that it was written, it sort of trips me up that the European Union is our largest trading partner. I thought, wait a minute, haven't we talked about China and Mexico and Canada as our largest trading partner? But we have to remember the European Union is a collection of countries. And when we're talking about goods and services, they're our largest trading partner. So a 15% tariff is what we've learned when it comes to a deal between these countries. I shouldn't say between these countries, between the bloc of countries and the United States. Although apparently France isn't that excited about it. So we say that there's a deal, but we want, you know, in what official capacity is this and how it's going to be applied and what is the reaction going to be? Perhaps there's still some fallout coming. We just this morning see the president meeting with the prime minister of the UK announcing a deal as well. So we have a few days for deals to come together, but the president is in Scotland. I thought you would find this interesting. He was asked this quite a bit by the Scottish press. And I didn't really know too much. It made me more interested in Donald Trump's mother, because obviously she's passed away. So we haven't seen her in the White House. And I say that unlike some other parents, for example, Michelle Obama's mother lived with the family and was part of the family very much during the administration. But I thought you would enjoy this photo. This is from the BBC. Donald Trump's mother from a Scottish island to New York's elite. It shows a picture of Marianne McLeod. And let me just read the first few paragraphs because it is very interesting. Marianne was one of tens of thousands of Scots who traveled to the U.S. and Canada in the early years of the last century looking to escape economic hardship at home. She first left Lewes for New York in 1930 at the age of 18 to seek work as a domestic servant. 6 years later, she was married to successful property developer Frederick Trump, the son of German migrants and one of the most eligible men in New York. So this story deserves a little bit more checking out, right? What was the backstory here? How did the two meet? It made me interested in that. And also, it is different. Think about the narrative of how we talk about the president of the United States. Obviously, a lot of people talk about President Trump, a rich, successful real estate mogul. How often do you hear that he was a son of a domestic servant who immigrated to New York City? You don't really hear that story. Everyone has a backstory. So it made me want to look into this backstory more. President Trump, during his meeting in Scotland, talked about his mom coming back to Scotland once a year, always with his sisters, because she wanted to visit family. And it was really important for her to get back home. So I thought that was sort of an interesting little nugget that we don't normally get a lot of that personal history from the president. And so this is one of the reasons why he says he feels an affinity for Scotland and wanted to be very clear that the deals that he was doing were going to be beneficial to Scotland, a small country, but an important one at that as well. So that's all happening in Europe. And there's a lot of conversations about what's happening with trade. And that obviously applies all over the world because the president is trying to pull together these deals from countries everywhere. While that's all happening, though, we see a renewed focus on the Middle East. And I'm getting a lot of questions from you about what's happening between Israel and Hamas, what's going on in Gaza, what is taking place in this particular area that we've covered so much over the last 2 years. You know, October will mark 2 years since the terrorist attacks that started this war. And there are some that will say, well, the conflict began way before the terrorist attacks. I understand that argument. But for our purposes here, this latest iteration of war started almost 2 years ago. We're moving towards that anniversary. And so at different times in different news cycles, we've seen a renewed focus back on this part of the world. And so we go away, we'll come back to the story, we go away, we come back to the story. But the war is still very much taking place. The latest focus is, though, on aid and what's happening with Gaza and what Palestinians, the people that are continuing to live in Gaza, what they have access to. And one of the things I was talking about with our Scoop insiders before we got on the air here was why that took place. Why is there a renewed focus? Why are we coming back to the story again now? Is it because Congress is off on recess? Is it because some of these domestic issues were sort of put on simmer, as we've talked about, because we're not going to pull them back in front of everybody until lawmakers start talking about them again? I don't know. I don't know really the reason for it. One of the reasons may be simply the power of the picture. And whatever we're talking about, whether it's video, photos, social media, we saw the New York Times, for example, with a really big picture. And I'm going to see if I could pull it up for you here. We had it in our notes section because I wanted to make sure that it was able to get into your newsletter. And so if I'm not able to pull it up here, I'll be sure to make sure that you have it in your notes. But this is one of the images. Let me go ahead and share this with you. This is a video part. You'll see the image of this, but you will also see the video in the New York Times of a woman that's cradling a child that is clearly struggling. And this particular article is about famine in Gaza. And so this seems to be where the focus really is. And you have the president speaking about this. The New York Times, in this piece that's stated from a few days ago, said this: Gazans are dying of starvation. And this is getting front page news again. The president just talked about this when he was in Scotland. It was one of the first things he talked about. And this is also important. So he has an opportunity, sitting down with the press, he can talk about whatever he wants. But as he's talking about trade, he immediately addresses this. And so I want you to listen to what he has to say. I cut together a few pieces throughout this conversation, which lasted more than an hour. So take a listen to what he has to say here.
We also discussed, obviously, Gaza. And I think before we get to phase two, which is, you know, what's going to happen afterwards, we want to get the children fed. We made a contribution a week ago of $60 million. All going into food. We only hope the food goes to the people that need it, because so much, as you know, when you do something there, it gets taken by Hamas or somebody, but it gets taken. You know, we want to help. It's a terrible situation. The whole thing is terrible. It's been bad for many years. We have to help on a humanitarian basis before we do anything. We have to get the kids fed. So we've been sending in a lot of food. A lot of the food that's been going there has been sent by the United States. It's very difficult to deal with Hamas, as I said. You know, we got a tremendous amount of hostages out, but it would take place in drips and drabs because they use them as a shield. And when they give them up, they no longer have a shield. And the people of Israel feel so strongly about the hostages. Hamas has become very difficult to deal with in the last couple of days because they don't want to give up these last 20, because they think as long as we have them, they have them, they have protection. But I don't think it can work that way. So I'm speaking to Bibi Netanyahu, and we are coming up with various plans. We're going to say it's a very difficult situation. You saw October 7th, and you saw what the damage and the horror that they committed. People can't forget that. You know, they tend to forget it, but they can't forget. That was one of the most evil things I've ever seen. And you just cannot forget that. So we're very much involved.
What more can Israel do against the communists as well?
Well, I think Israel can do a lot. I will say that Iran, I think, interjected themselves in this last negotiation. Can you imagine the beating they took? We wiped out their nuclear possibilities. They can start again. If they do, we'll wipe it out faster than you can wave your finger at it. We'll have to do that. We will do that gladly, openly and gladly. They've been saying, Iran's been sending out bad signals, I'll tell you. For a country that just got wiped out, they've been sending very bad signals, very nasty signals. And they shouldn't be doing that. They shouldn't be doing that. And I think they got involved in this negotiation, telling Hamas and giving Hamas signals and orders, and that's not good.
So the president said a few things there that I think is really important. One of the things he said is that there's some sort of new plans that he's negotiating or talking about with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. It also is the doubling down. Another piece of news that came from this is the president talking about more aid flowing to people in Gaza. But it's also important for you to know, if you're in the American audience, that aid has continued. The United States has continued to push aid towards this part of the world. The question isn't necessarily whether or not we've greenlit aid. It's whether or not it gets to where it's going. And this is part of the main points of conflict. There's many points of conflict, obviously. But this has been a major point of conflict because there's been a change in the way that aid has been delivered. In the past, there was a total reliance, or very much a reliance, on the United Nations and a few different organizations to deliver aid. Some of those organizations are still operating, and some are not, because there's been doubt cast by the Israelis and the United States and others that some of the UN organizations were working in tandem with Hamas, and that that was causing problems where aid was not getting to the people. And so there was a new group that's come up, which is the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF. You're going to hear a lot about them because this has been a very controversial group, backed by Israel and American contractors, military contractors. And it was a new way, apparently, to try to get aid to the people that needed it most, but not get it in the hands of Hamas. And there's been a whole lot of controversy surrounding that. In fact, I do have some sound from Anthony Aguilar. He recently spoke to the BBC. He's a former Green Beret, and he was part of this group, part of the military contractors that were helping this group function in Gaza in a very volatile situation in a war zone. But I want you to hear what he has to say. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the format in which he talks, because I think that's important. But I want you to be able to see and hear from him. I just want to make sure I have the right sound, because I have a few things in front of me. So here's Anthony Aguilar. He's speaking to the BBC. When you hear someone with the British accent, that's the journalist speaking to him on Zoom.
I witnessed the Israeli Defense Forces shooting at the crowds of Palestinians. I witnessed the Israeli Defense Forces firing a main gun tank round from the Merkava tank into a crowd of people, destroying a car of civilians that were simply driving away from the site. I witnessed mortar rounds being fired at the crowds of people to keep them controlled.
As a professional soldier with a very long career, what was your professional opinion of what was happening?
My professional opinion of how the sites were established was what I would describe as amateur. Inexperienced, untrained, no idea of how to conduct operations of this magnitude. That would be my most benign assessment. In my most frank assessment, I would say that they're criminal. In my entire career, have I never witnessed the level of brutality and use of indiscriminate and unnecessary force against a civilian population, an unarmed, starving population. I've never witnessed that in all of the places I've been deployed to war until I was in Gaza at the hands of the IDF and U.S. contractors.
Based on the knowledge you have, do you think that you were a witness then to war crimes? I think you're saying that very emphatically.
Without question, I witnessed war crimes.
So the way in which he's speaking, I'm curious about, because this is, on a video interview, apparently. This is what the BBC is saying. But you can see the way that he's talking. He's. I'm wondering how many times he's repeated some of these answers, because sometimes it doesn't feel completely natural the way that he's saying the answers. And that can happen in the news, by the way. You ask someone to repeat something a few different times because you're looking for them to speak clearly. And sometimes they're just not speaking clearly. But I'm very curious to get a response from the Pentagon. I'd like to know a little bit more about this person. Where is he from? Where did he serve? When he talks about working multiple places, where has he worked? He's obviously being very critical of the United States. So I think this deserves a response from the Pentagon so that we could balance it out. But I also wanted you to hear his perspective, because as we're taking in what are the stories that people are hearing around the world? If you're watching the BBC, which many of us are not watching the BBC at home or on our social medias, this is some of what you're seeing. And so you get this groundswell of critique of Israel and as well of the United States. Where is that coming from? Well, it's coming from places like this particular interview. It's also coming from our own lawmakers. And I'm going to play for you now, and then we'll talk about all of this. We'll kind of sort through all of this. I want you just to get a bunch of different sound in front of you. I have Senator Van Hollen from Maryland. He's a Democrat. He's very critical of the United States and the way that we've been providing aid to Israel and what's going to be happening next. You have Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. He is supportive of Israel, and you're going to hear that as well. What I did hear is I took sound from Senator Van Hollen. He's going to be answering a question about aid. And then I took sound from Senator Lindsey Graham, and I put them together. So you can sort of hear them next to each other about how they're speaking about this. One thing for clarification, so you have the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF, which has been controversial and the way that aid has been trying to get into Gaza at this time. And Whitney, you asked a good question. You said, why can't someone make sure the food goes to the Palestinian people and not Hamas? There has to be a way to make sure it goes to the people who need it, not Hamas. That has been the puzzle piece. But remember, Gaza is completely run by Hamas. It is a terrorist state. There are a lot of places around the world that people can, that aid can flow. But inside a terrorist state, it's different. Where, for example, American journalists can often get into a country like Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and they're going to report. Very few American journalists, if any, have gotten into Gaza. Why is that? Because it's a terrorist state. Because we, speaking as journalists, don't really have the support of the American government or the Israeli government to come help us if we need it. So one of the ways I've thought about Hamas, and I've hesitated sharing this with you because I think you got to be really careful with comparisons, but I actually think this works. And because I'm Italian-American, I'm going to go with the stereotype for you for a moment. So I want you to imagine a New York City neighborhood that's run by the mafia, right? Mafia is organized crime. And if people are living in New York City, but they're behaving under the rules of the mafia because they don't want to cross the mafia because the organized crime group runs the neighborhood. Think about that on a much bigger scale with Hamas. It's a terrorist organization, so it's not just organized crime, but it's a huge gang that's running this entire area. So in order to function, you have to have a relationship with Hamas. And the question is, well, who has that relationship? For example, do aid groups have that relationship where they give a little something to Hamas so that they can operate in the bigger areas to reach the children or the refugee areas? Well, that's one thing. But if the aid groups are actually having to work with Hamas or Hamas representatives or Hamas operatives have to be part of the aid group to operate in Gaza, then now we're in a little bit more of a challenge, right? A conundrum. So if my U.S. dollars are going to an aid group that has to have Hamas representatives as part of the aid group, then am I supporting a terrorist organization, which is against the law in the United States and obviously counterproductive to what is trying to be achieved here by Israel, our ally, which is to remove Hamas completely from Gaza so that the people are not living underneath this terrorist rule. There will be those that say that's not what Israel is doing. They're targeting this entire group of people, not just the terrorist group. And now, and obviously you've heard that critique before. So with that little bit of background, let me play for you the sound that includes, we're going to have Senator Van Hollen, Senator Graham, Senator Van Hollen again, and then we're going to talk about this.
But the Trump administration says this is the best way. This is the only way to keep money, to keep food out of the hands of Hamas, which financially benefits off reselling it to desperate, starving people. Is there another way to feed desperate, starving people?
Yes, and this is a big lie. The claim that when the UN organizations were delivering food to Palestinians, civilians, that it was being systematically diverted to Hamas. I want to say loudly and clearly, this is a big lie.
Trump the systematic it, part of that.
The systematic, but that is their claim. They claim that essentially large amounts of aid are being diverted to Hamas. What the Netanyahu government did was scrap a delivery system that was working at delivering food and assistance in favor of this other effort. That was a pretext, this claim that Hamas was systematically diverting food. The real goal of this other effort is to use food as a weapon of war and population control.
That's a violation of international law.
Yes, it is.
That's a human rights abuse. Senator Lindsey Graham was on Meet the Press this morning, and I want to ask for your reaction to something he said, because he was very strong in his words.
Well, I talked to Cindy McCain last night. Here's some good news for the people in Gaza. Humanitarian quarters are now going to be open. Israel's going to work with the UN, the World Food Program, to get some food into these people who need it. But I think what the topic we're talking about today is a change in strategy. I think President Trump has come to believe, and I certainly have come to believe, there's no way you're going to negotiate an end to this war with Hamas. Hamas is a terrorist organization who is chartered to destroy the state of Israel. They're religious Nazis. They hold Israeli hostages. I think Israel's come to conclude that they can't achieve a goal of ending the war with Hamas that would be satisfactory to the safety of Israel. And if they're going to do in Gaza what we did in Tokyo and Berlin, take the place by force, then start over again, presenting a better future for the Palestinians, hopefully having the Arabs take over the West Bank and Gaza.
The United States is a huge supporter of the state of Israel. Is there anything that could prevent what he says is about to happen?
Well, the United States should make very clear that it's unacceptable to use U.S. weapons to target or indiscriminately fire on civilians and civilian infrastructure.
Does this sound like an occupation?
Well, we also know just this week, members of the Netanyahu coalition, in fact, government ministers, called for essentially erasing Gaza, and they said it will become a Jewish state, statelet, and part of the, so this was one
Netanyahu
of the—
Netanyahu did say he didn't agree with this.
Well, statement. Here's the problem, though, Margaret. We continually see that Netanyahu, at the end of the day, does cater to his most far-right wing of his government. People like Ben-Gvir, people like Smotrich. That is what has allowed him to stay in power. And so at the end of the day, he takes the most extreme—
I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought, and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat. And I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S. And then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington Red Raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice.
Positions.
Okay, so that's a critic of Prime Minister Netanyahu explaining how he sees it and the politics of Israel influencing the latest decisions. If you take the other side of this, what you'll hear from those that support Prime Minister Netanyahu is that there's no, and including Lindsey Graham, which is what Lindsey Graham was saying there, that there's no end to this conflict unless there's an end to Hamas. And there's no end to Hamas if there is not total devastation. And these are very scary words to even speak out loud. But this is what is actually playing out on the world stage by some of the biggest leaders there. Natalia asked a great question, which is, can the refugees try to leave? Can the Palestinians try to leave? And Tara, you jumped on and also were asking that question, you know, where they would be able to go. You said, Tara said, I think there is nowhere for them to go. And would Hamas let them go? Also a great question. Right now, there is nowhere for these Palestinians to go. And one of the negotiating points by President Trump and others has been to ask other Arab nations to essentially evacuate these Palestinians, that they would be able to leave and go somewhere else. Egypt, for example, a country very close by, built these huge walls to keep people from coming into their country. So there have been very few Arab nations, none, that have come forward with a plan on how to evacuate these refugees, let alone a question about whether Hamas would let them leave, let alone a question about whether or not these Palestinians would leave. Because if they leave, there is a question for them and for others about whether or not that land that they believe belongs to them would stay with the Palestinians, that would stay under Palestinian leadership in some way. Yes, remove Hamas, but then can the Palestinians, the Muslims stay there next to the Jewish state? Would the Jewish state allow the Muslims to stay there? Is there actually a genocide that's happening? We look up genocide. I always think it's important to go with the definition of it and the way that, you know, by the way, you can see it in a few different ways. So I'm going to try to pull up, how about we go with, isn't it crazy where you have to even think about the source for something like the word genocide? Let's just go with the Encyclopedia Britannica, because I feel like everything else that I see someone could have an issue with politically. Genocide, the deliberate and systemic systematic destruction of a group of people because of their ethnicity, nationality, religion, or race. And so that's why the term genocide has come up repeatedly, saying this is what Israel is actually doing, not going after Hamas. Israel say that's not what we're doing. We're going after the terrorist group. And so here we have all sides sort of staring at each other yet again. Some of you on the live chat have mentioned this question about, well, what about reliable information? And I wish I had a better solution for you, a better way of saying, here's this side, here's another side, and here's something to consider, as I do with a lot of topics. What's very difficult about this is that we don't have independent journalists on the ground in Gaza. We have a few that are working for news organizations like NPR or the Associated Press or some of these big newswire services that continue to work in the area and do so with very little protection. So that's very helpful, but it's limited. We do have some quotes. So for example, from the World Food Program, WFP. I know I'm throwing a lot of acronyms at you, but you might hear about the World Food Program. You heard Senator Lindsey Graham mention Cindy McCain. Cindy McCain, the wife of the late Senator John McCain, is the head of the World Food Program. And what the World Food Program reported over the last week is that there's new and astonishing levels of desperation in Gaza, that a third of the population are not eating for multiple days. And so here you have that voice entering the chat, right? You have the we're getting a preponderance of reports that are suggesting that starvation and famine is a real issue in Gaza. And then you have Israel that will say, well, we have been letting aid go in, but it can't get to where it needs to go because these other UN agencies and other groups that we're supposed to be partnering with aren't really helping us. So we're trying our new way with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is also very controversial, to try to get food to the people. So you have everyone sort of pointing fingers at each other saying, you're the reason we can't get the aid. You're the reason we can't get the aid. This is what's happening. In the meantime, you do have innocent people caught in all of this that are just trying to survive. At the same time, we have a media component as well. We can't ignore that. And it's difficult. This is very difficult because if I see a government retweet something, I'm going to pay attention to it, but then I have trouble validating it. So let me give you an example of this. I showed you this image coming from the New York Times. And one of the key images that you likely saw this week is the one of a woman that is holding a child that looks extremely sick. And the whole article is detailing the amount of challenges that these families are facing just to feed their families. So you'll see this image. It was one of the images that was on the front page of the New York Times. Well, Israel's foreign ministry shared, and I'll share it with you here, a report by an investigative journalist who I am not familiar with his work, talking about that the child that the New York Times is featuring is a child that has a series of other, here, I'm going to show it to you, a series of other problems that, yes, they weren't ignoring the fact that getting food to this child could be an issue, but that the child is also, he showed another picture of the mother and the brother, and he says, well, the media is choosing not to show this, these photographs of the mother and brother that are healthy and fed, and went on to say that this particular child that was shown as an image of starvation also suffers from cerebral palsy and was born with a serious genetic disorder. And so part of the reason why that image is shared around the world is because this child looks so sick, but he may also be suffering from other conditions. And so for me as a journalist, I'm looking at this wondering, well, what do I do with that? Because I don't want to show you just the one image from the New York Times. If there's doubt about it from an investigative journalist that I don't know, but the Israeli government is validating, how do you sort through this? And if you try to show, this is what's difficult, right? If you try to talk about both sides, if you talk about Hamas as a terrorist group, if you talk about how this terrorist group has terrorized the people of Gaza, as well as the people of Israel, then one of the critiques that we'll receive is, well, you're supporting genocide because you're not paying enough attention to the starving children and all of this, which of course is something that no one would ever want to do, support the genocide of anybody and the harm of any child. But this also deserves the discussion because it's part of the reason why there has been no solution. You see these sides looking at each other, blaming each other for the lack of aid and wondering, how does this end? And so part of the reason why I wanted to share what Senator Graham said is he's describing a situation of total devastation and potentially a lot more casualties of war. And what is that scenario? In the meantime, President Trump is talking about a potential solution with Bibi Netanyahu. What is that scenario? You have Israel coming out today and saying they're halting military operations to allow more aid to flow in, but also saying they've allowed aid for the last several months. They're just not responsible for it not getting to the right people. So around and around we go. And in the middle of all of this, as we know, there are a lot of people even in the United States, you have the two strong sides, right? You have the conservatives and you have the liberals, and you have someone's really conservative, someone's really liberal. They're yelling at each other. But then there's all these people in the middle sort of watching this wondering, hey, I'm just trying to live my life. And so I apply that to other places around the world where it's easy to have people guilty because of association. Well, all Israelis think like Benjamin Netanyahu. No, that's not the case. We know that's not the case. Israelis have been protesting Prime Minister Netanyahu for nearly 2 years now. Oh, well, if you live in Gaza, you must have, you know, you kind of have to work with Hamas, so you must be sympathetic towards them. I don't know that to be true, that everyone in Gaza is sympathetic to Hamas if you're just trying to survive. So this is the sort of tone, and it's very difficult to do this in a 26-minute broadcast on the evening news, let alone a 30-second clip on social media. And here's where this gets it to be a very difficult story to report. So one of the things that we're trying to do is show you all of these sides so you can consider it for yourself. And we'll continue to watch to see what new developments come. So we have a couple things to watch this week. We have a few different sound bites to consider. And where it goes from here, we're just going to have to wait and see, unfortunately. So, but that's why we're seeing a gathering of momentum towards this story. One story I want to mention to you real quick before we leave is a story that we've covered for the last several weeks, but the pace of the news has sort of slowed as we would be the case. And that is the story of the historic flooding in Kerr County, Texas. I had the opportunity to go out to Kerr County just yesterday, sort of spur of the moment. And it was a experience that I want to share with you. I'm still sort of reflecting on it because I went out there just as a person. I didn't go out there as a journalist seeking a story, trying to think about what image to capture for you. By the way, photography and video doesn't really do much to actually express what it looks like there. And this is almost a month after the event. It still is very difficult to describe. So I didn't go out there as a journalist, although I am always like keeping an eye on what stories could be possible. I think I found a few that I would love to be able to pursue for you. I didn't go out as a volunteer, as I was trying to do for weeks, and things weren't just working out the way that we were hoping them to work out, and where I could get my hands dirty. I wasn't able to do that. I just went out as a person. I just went out just to pay my respects, really. That's what it was really about, and to get an understanding. And so I wanted to share a few things with you. One of the things I did see, and you've probably seen this on a few different images, is the image of a memorial wall that is put up for all of the victims of this flood. It's more than 130 people. So a very devastating event. And this wall goes for, you know, more than a block. What I would consider a city block. It kind of goes along this long stretch of sidewalk. So difficult to kind of talk about it in that term. What's interesting about this is that from where you're standing, looking at this wall, the water is just on the other side, but you don't really see it. And in fact, you can continue down the street called Water Street or Water Avenue, pardon me, to those in Kerrville who live there, and there's no water there. The river is nearby, but the flooding didn't go into the particularly populated city area of Kerrville. It flowed in a way that until you see it, it's hard to explain. Yes, it was along the river itself, but it sort of bent and curved in strange ways as the water came at such high volume. So you'll have these parts of the river that it's not that they look untouched, because they definitely look like there's more debris, but it doesn't look like total devastation. And then you'll look just a few yards away and it's total devastation. So the water sort of moved in this way that allowed it to go to places that it wouldn't have necessarily expected. You know, when I think of a river flooding, I think about the river, you know, rising. I don't think about it widening in the way that you see it when you're there. And it widened in a way to kind of cut through these areas that then were people were living or camping, but not necessarily right on top of the river. And that was one of the extraordinary things too, that you would see these areas, not only that were parts that were sort of untouched, but where there was no water now. And so you're looking at an area devastated by water and not seeing any water. And that was very sort of disorienting, because you had to imagine for yourself what that would look like. And it seems so beyond what you're able to imagine. The expression that came to mind, and I'll share this with you, I already just want to offer a disclaimer to pardon the offense. When I grew up in San Francisco, I used the term, oh my God, all the time. we'd say it with friends. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. We just sort of say it very casually. I didn't realize that some people considered it a slang term or taking the Lord's name in vain until I was a national news anchor and I'd said it out loud and realized that, oh, some people take offense to that. And by the way, there's several things that are like that, but I really had to correct myself. So I don't say, oh my God anymore. Not even really casually. I say, oh my gosh, or something like that. And I had to really train myself. We turned down a bridge sort of area. And all I said was, oh my God. Like that was the only thing to say because the destruction is just so massive. I want to show you a few other pictures. Again, the pictures, it's really hard to do it justice, but I want to show you a few things here. One is an image, and I'm going to pull it up as big as I can for those that are watching live. One of the things that also was very striking in the area is you see these amazing, huge cypress trees, and they are everywhere and beautiful, and not all of them were destroyed. In some areas in flooding in the Elk Country, all the trees will be taken, but not here. There were still many areas that were incredibly beautiful despite all of the destruction that took place. But one of the things that you would see is if you looked way up in the trees, there were still items in the trees that a typical ladder would not reach. So the items in this particular picture, you can see sort of a mattress up in the tree, probably 30 feet. There's a man in a blue shirt standing next to it. And you could see it would probably be about four or five of them, of him, to get to the place where the water must have gone to thrown this mattress all the way up there. You can also see the markings on the trees, just where the water was moving with such force, it sort of filed the tree bark and stripped it away. And so that was something that was very difficult to see because you would see all these trees still in their glory. They're so green and they look so amazing. And you're so grateful that they're still standing there over this river. And then you look up. And one of the things I saw when I looked up is, and only a mother would know this, it's like a sling, like a plastic sling that you could use in a bathtub or you would use for your kiddo to sit in when they were real little. And that was way at the top of a tree. And that image really struck me as a mother thinking about a baby toy so far up in this tree. This image is a image of me standing next to one of the big trees that's still standing, and it would take four or five of me. I'm standing a little bit elevated next to the tree trunk. So from where the picture is being taken, it's probably 5 feet up to the tree. And then you can see if you look up to the sort of into the branches of the tree, you can see where the bark has been filed down. And to be next to it, to imagine the water that high is extremely difficult. I'm going to share a little video here next of some of the debris. And I want you to see the juxtaposition of the debris next to this beautiful field that's still there and the beautiful trees that are still standing there. But the way that the river moved, it took off part of the shore, but left others standing. You can see my son there down at the shore, if you will. And you can see him standing at the riverbank. And how little he is compared to these big trees. So to wrap your mind around it was very difficult. The other really important part, and officials said this time and time again, but we're taught to be skeptical of officials. We have a track record in America. We're skeptical of those in power, period, but always skeptical of those that are trying to tell us that, oh, this wasn't an option. What you're seeing on your screen now is where I was walking at Heart of the Hills, one of the girls' camps in Hunt that was affected. And this camp was completely and totally destroyed. By saving grace, there were no campers here. Unlike Camp Mystic, they didn't have a session. Their session was going to start in a couple days. And so there were no campers. This was right next to the river. If there were campers here, what I learned is the evacuation route would have let them right into the water. So where you are and where I'm standing here is a two-lane road. And where I was standing, where I was showing you some of the bigger trees, was also a two-lane road. For you on podcast listening, it's just imagine you're a two-lane country road along a river, a beautiful river with, you know, these houses sort of nearby, not right next to the river. A lot of them are high up. You know, they're a little bit of a walk away from it, but the water was able to reach them. One of the things that officials said is if we ordered evacuating the hill country is not like evacuating other places. there's all these two-lane roads and low water crossings, and it would be a disaster. But you hear that and you wonder, yeah, you're just trying to cover yourself, because really, if you ordered an evacuation, people would have been able to get out. Come on. When you're there driving these roads, you realize what they're saying has merit. And we talked about that at the time, that it was difficult to imagine the hill country if you haven't been here. And it is very much like a movie set. You have these two-lane roads through the country with the big trees and the beautiful water. And it feels like a Western movie. It does. Just a little personal anecdote. My in-laws were staying with my kids in one of the houses that eventually had some water in it 3 weeks before the flood happened, because they were dropping off my nieces and nephews at camp. And I didn't share this story before because it felt so irrelevant to whatever everyone else was dealing with. Our family was fine. The kids were able to move along from camp just fine. But seeing where they were staying gave me new perspective about why I should share this with you. The house where they were staying would have been safe. It got a little bit of water in it. The river would have been very, very, very frightening. And as my father-in-law said, he said, you know, we sleep with a lot of noise machines and fans. Their family does. And we wouldn't have heard anything until the water was right at the door. We just wouldn't have heard it because it happened so fast. And everyone that we talked to said that. It happened in 30 minutes, in 30 minutes, in 30 minutes. The water came up 30 feet. Like, it's huge, this huge wave. And so my family, if they would have stayed in the house, they would have been fine. But I don't think they would have stayed in the house. I think they would have looked at that and realized that the road was fine, and they have lived through many hurricanes, and they know that you probably need to get out of there. You probably need to make a decision and go. And if they would have made the decision to leave, there's no way they would have survived, because the road that they were taking was going to go through several low water points and right through the center of a town that was completely destroyed. And it would have been, they would have been trapped. It would have been absolutely impossible. I mean, that was a very frightening realization, that if you were in the house, you had to stay, but you were in grave danger, and leaving, you really had no path. And so also speaking to folks that were in the area for some time, you realize how absolutely historic this flood really was, and how difficult it was to anticipate which way the water was heading, how it was hitting different areas, why certain communities didn't even know flooding was happening 10 minutes away from them because of the way that the water moved. So hopefully we'll learn a little bit more from this community. The community is still undergoing a huge amount of recovery. The search and rescue teams are still there. Fire departments from all over the place, multiple states are still on scene. Many roads are completely blocked off from access still. And there's an immense amount of cleanup that still needs to be done. I mean, it's again, beyond really articulation. It's very difficult to explain because it's just so big. But one of the things I was struck by at the memorial wall was the amazing show of faith. And that's the other thing that the locals were talking about how faith has helped them, but how much faith that they've seen for people believing in God and believing in something bigger than themselves and leaning on faith to get them through this. And that has been something that's been startling. And although we would prefer that no one would have to experience faith in that way, encouraging at an extremely dark time. One of the quotes in the memorial wall is a quote from the Bible, and I'm going to pull up the picture. I don't think I was able to get it up for you, but I want to make sure that I am quoting the exact one that I'll also share with you. I'll make sure to put this in the show notes as well. There were so many incredible Bible verses that were selected by strangers on the memorial wall, but one of them was from Isaiah 43:2, "When you go through deep waters, I will be with you." And it, just like the fact that they could put that up so close to the river, knowing that they're honoring these innocent people that were killed by this horrific event, but leaning on the faith that there would be comfort and redemption and hope, was something I really walked away with. So I typically don't share Bible verses with you here on Smarter News, but that it was absolutely part of the story. I mean, so many Bible verses, so many different quotes talking about faith and the importance of having faith and real hope. And so I want to share that with you as well. It'll continue to be a story to watch. These camps in the area were historic, you know, 100-year plus camps that have been around the Texas community for a long time. And many families really affected by this, obviously with the loss of children, but many families affected with also with their family traditions and it's a culture too. And it was very, very difficult to be anywhere close to this and not think about the children that were lost. This older man walked up to the wall as I was standing there, and he just, you know, I could just, as soon as he started talking, kind of made, just as I said, I turned around and said, "Oh my God," he walked up and he had kind of the same expression, and you could hear that his voice was quivering because it's just to see sweet children that were affected and so many families. And now a question for so many families in the future, what that holds for them. So it was a really important experience. I'm grateful to have it and hope that I can do some more reporting for you that feels appropriate. That was what I was always worried about is, and it comes up in this question about what we covered with Israel as well and Gaza, which is when you're using images, you want them to be about information and reliable information. You don't want to be using them for exploitation. And as a journalist, I was very aware of that with something, an event that hit so close to home, that I didn't want to just go stand in the rain somewhere like a typical reporter and try to use it as a way to elevate Smarter News. I wanted to be able to tell some real stories that really mattered, that would be helpful to you and could be in the information category. We also, though, need to share stories about each other because that's how we maintain our humanity. And so that's what I look at when I look at images. Is there information? Is there humanity there? What is this about? Is it reliable? Is it informative? Is it helpful to people? And so that's some of the, I was really struggling with that for this particular event, but it's something that we struggle with for a lot of stories, isn't it? So it's not unique just to this. Anyhow, I wanted to just share that little personal reporter's notebook with you that wasn't really from a reporter, was just from a mom. But I did get a little information. I did, but when someone's talking to me off the record, I don't just share it, it's not like I have the conversation and then sneakily, say, okay, now I'm going to share this with my, no, like it has to be in an official capacity. Otherwise I'd have no friends. So anyhow, I'll continue to keep this story on your radar because I think there is a lot of questions here with this particular story in Texas that we can also apply. We saw flooding around the United States in the weeks that followed. There's a question about how to use technology to better warn people and a question about, what are the right policies that are in place. There's a lot of things that we can continue to talk about. And then there's the families at the heart of it, the families who lost loved ones and the families who lost loved ones and also lost community. And how do these families rebuild? And what I saw there was an incredible resilience that I wanted to make sure to pass along. Not resilience where we can forget about them, but resilience in that it was very inspiring. So I hope you feel that as well. In the meantime, we'll keep you posted on all of these developing news stories. If you have questions, comments, thoughts, please go ahead and email us hello@smarternews.com or scoop@smarternews.com. You could use both. I love hearing from you. And we will try to get answers to your questions. But appreciate your support of quick, concise, nonpartisan Smarter News. And I hope you have a great week. I'll see you back second week of August. God willing, I'll be here. And we'll have, I'm sure, a whole bunch of other stories, personal and otherwise, to share. All right, guys, have a great week, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.